丈夫
です。
Onion told stories of what happened within that organization. So, again, François, speaking to me of the floor.
Yep, so I've been digging a bit in some space websites just to get some figure. So there are reckons and there is a big change in immigration during the last couple of years. For example, in 2003, in Northern Ireland, there were just 26,000 foreigners, people who haven't been born in the UK or Ireland. While from 2003 and 2007, depending on the national national health number, there seems to 165,000 immigrants, as myself, just came to Northern Ireland. So there is more or less, the state thinks that some 40 or 50% of them just went back. So we can say that more or less there is 100,000 more immigrants that came in the last couple of years. So, which is kind of a big increase. So, what happened is due to those this increase. Now immigration seems to be something that the states take care of due to the prejudice. So that ran a kind of omnibus research. So just a poll. 2007 on 52% of people answered wanted more restriction on immigrants, while just 50% of the people answering were saying that they were meeting an immigrant worker once a week, which is for me quite strange, but I get in contact with migrant worker every day, so I think there is at least 50% of people just don't see them. Speaking about prejudice, 24% of the guy once heard says that Northern Irish people have a prejudice, where just 3% of them say I've got a prejudice. So as usual, people don't have any problem, but the other one got it. So, and all this 20% got prejudice, and so it's, but 50% reckon that agrees that migrant workers are good for the economy. So it's just kind of alpha. And all those numbers were kind of there were no difference between city and countryside. So those poll was a bit strange because, as usual, the way you're asking the question, you can get the answer you want. But at least it's something that we have to. There is kind of the big stuff. Is 50% of the population want more restriction on migrants, which is a bit mad. I think it's kind of what I can say about those numbers.
Okay, I'll open up a discussion now, any points that people want to raise about, and then we can come back and I'll tell you a bit of piece about the history of the ARA in recent years. So if anybody has any points or questions in regard to that?
I've got one point. It's hard to, when people speak about migrants worker, you have in Syria there is a prejudice about certain nationality, because as a French, I have not at all any problem, and I can feel it with my kind of Eastern European friend. I don't feel any prejudice. Why is it good? So we can't put migrant worker at there is not one big migrant worker. It's more what people think about migrant workers that took their job on kind of the old the Western Europe, which even more than happy to see me in Belfast. Great, good change. Let's chat. While some other, it's not exactly the same. I've just been insulted once. I've been treated as a Spaniard, which is fair enough for me.
I can give a recent example of I was working as a car park attendant over the last couple of weeks, and I knew and I heard from workers there that they built up and helped a migrant worker. There was a Russian fella who was sleeping rough just beside the car park, and the people I was speaking to, they actually brought him in and learned to be wet, clean himself and get washed, etc. And then eventually they got him a job within the same workplace within the car park. So that's just basically a small example of stuff that's probably isn't mentioned in the mainstream media, and the idea that somehow Belfast is an English based city in Europe. So that's just an example of solidarity with American workers.
Is it interesting? I think they get people are dealing with individual views, but actually, they get an individual. They're much more likely to be. You ask people in a general context, do you think that we need a border control? And most people say, I think we do. But you can get it, do you think this person should be building the country? Like, oh, well, I don't know about that. Like, so, suppose how you move the debate onto from just being this general automatic thing, we need a border control, to looking more sort of individual cases.
I just come in with another point. So, I remember growing up here in Belfast in the 70s, and there were very few people from who weren't so-called born here in the north of Ireland. There were very few different faces and very few different accents. I was one of the very few black faces growing up here in the 70s. And then the scene developed over the last decade or so of the rise and racist attacks and the rise of racism. And why I separated two, even though they're linked, is that there was the visible rise of racist attacks, and then there is the less overt racism, which can be very subtle in daily work and daily life. And I remember coming to an understanding that, you know, the rise of racism is incorporated into two reasons. The first reason is you've seen the development of the peace process, and you're seeing more and more migrant workers coming here to the north of Ireland. And the second thing is that racism is always inherent within the system in which we live, under capitalism. In that regard, capitalism puts worker against worker. And because of that, they use the concept of divide and rule. Do it in the issue of nationality, but also do it in the issue of sexual orientation. And more recently here, we've seen an issue of race. So we've seen a situation arise where, you know, with the migrant workers coming here, and looking to have a decent life and stuff, that you had those organisations and individuals saying, we're coming here to take our jobs, to take our houses. But at the end of the day, the reality is that there's a lot of work out there coming in, which is ill-paid. There's very little social housing being built. So it's actually inherent within the system as well. But it's coupled with the peace process, because if you see any development of any situation where a country is coming from conflict to post-conflict, and you see reconstruction, which takes place within, let's say, a nation state, then you will get those who will see people coming in, perceiving coming in, and taking those jobs and stuff. I remember back whenever this was on the rise, I was involved in the Belfast anti-war movement, and I remember starting off sitting in a room where there were four people saying, well, what will you do against the possible oncoming war? And then I remember sitting in a room with a couple of people saying, what can we do about racism? And lots of different issues were raised. People said we couldn't do nothing. There's other people said, so we have to go down the route of, you know, getting people put into jail and prosecuting people. There's other people said, well, we need to mobilise people on the streets. And there was a lot of discussion taken within that there, and there was a lot of debate on the issue of racism vis-a-vis fascist organisations. And that was a very interesting and informative discussion, which I was glad to take part in. And those discussions actually started to materialise to the process of the anti-racism network starting to take the mobilisation of the streets. And there was a lot of people within the organisation itself, you know, who had problems with different ways of which it was orientated. But the concept at that time was to build a united front of people who wanted the deportation of immigration through the judiciary, and there's other people who wanted to actually go out and confront racism on the streets and indeed some individual fascists. So it was the bringing together of all those into a collective where people within each part of the organisation could have their own say and try and influence, convince others to go in that direction. So what we've seen was mobilisations in the city centre. We started to see mobilisations in different communities, which was really good. And there was a lot of different action taken. There was paint-outs, sprayers, there was gigs put on, there was mobilisations, there was people going to help people move from the house or pull out of the house. And there was even discussions at the time of setting up, by some individuals at the time, setting up squads. Because as the issue developed, you know, there was more and more racist attacks. And so there came an understanding that the march, not only individuals, but the marches themselves would have to be protected. And that would mean physical confrontation with those who had attacked. So there was the beginnings of that, and this is the first time I've actually said that there was the beginnings of the development of that protection, of people who are going to physically defend the protests and the marches, and also, if needs be, to go on the offensive if the situation further arose. So that was being discussed within certain individuals at that time. Then there was other issues in regard to immigration and stuff like that, and there was protests held up at the immigration control. There was people who were going to be deported and protest against that as well. But what you've seen developed is from the nucleus of three or four people in a room to eventually mobilisation of thousands of citizens and also communities coming together to take a stand against it. And because of that, there, and the lesson I've always learned is that groundswell from below had made others move in bigger circles. To such an extent that we were being criticised by the state, by the police, there were politicians coming out to condemn us as well. But the reality was that the groundswell from below was to such an extent that we were able to bring people in, and there was a lot of debate about this, into that there fold for that specific period of time, and that was a tactic. Because while the ARN could mobilise people in specific areas, there were areas that they couldn't mobilise in. And the reality was that if we went into that area at that specific time, given the parliamentary history of different organisations and given what was going on in the ground in relation to paramilitaries, violent paramilitary organisations, that there would be a repercussion. And I told the no certain parents myself that there would be a repercussion, and the repercussion would be an increase in the attacks in the minority community, which would result in death. And there was murders at the time. There was people drilled out of their houses and beaten in the guard and all that stuff. So again, that was all tactical in relation to that of how to actually support migrants and people from who speak different and who look different, and that whole perception within that time. So why did we mobilise in different areas? Those areas had to be dealt with differently. And I think if we look at the situation politically, we now see ourselves moving towards what the bureaucracy and the ruling class has called a normal society. But the reality is that a normal society within it has inherent discrimination, and inherently within the whole system itself to control the citizens and the people, they will always use the issue of divine rule as and when it's required. In this period of time, we see a situation where everyone wants to come together and get the situation moved on, because the reality is many people have lived through a brutal war. We've witnessed brutality, murders, deaths, state persecution, state repression, everything on the streets. And for a lot of people, they're trying to see a better future for their children. And as that materializes, that the so-called ruling class will get their normal society. But what you will see is more and more people realizing this normal society is, in many ways, little different, apart from the overt war off the streets, to their lives. No doubt there's opportunities for people today, but, you know, social housing, the issue of social housing is still there, the issue of discrimination is still there, the issue of low-paid workers is still there, all those issues are still there. And bubbling underneath that there, you will see, once again, I believe, not only the rise of racism, but given the development of the peace process and the eventual demise of the Park organizations, you'll see a rise in beginnings of individuals transitioning to fascist organizations. And that's a so-called normal society in the interest of the ruling class. So there's a lot of lessons I've learned from that situation. And I think it has to be put in context of what I started off and said, is it has to be put in context of to learn the lessons historically of post-conflict situations, the reconstruction of those societies, the interest of the nation state and the ruling class within those societies, and in tandem, couple that with the whole interest of this system of capitalism under which we live. And within that situation, there will always be tensions, there will always be division or rise, unless the whole system itself of capitalism is overthrown and is replaced by a different system of the interest of the world class citizens are to the fore rather than the interest of a small minority. And I think, you know, over time we will see more and more education on the streets in regards to that. And the final thing I'll say is that the issue here is also seen, you'll see a couple with the rise of nationalist sentiment in many ways, and that is always used in whatever conflict, you know what I mean, to keep the interest of its people there. And you will see the rise of more agitation, of young, more and more young people becoming disillusioned with, you know, what little that they have and what little they perceive they will get, and you'll see agitation again on the street. So at the end of the day, you know, for ourselves, you know, our support and solidarity has to always lie with the most vulnerable, and collectively within the working class, that's where the roots of change will develop a commission to actually bring a better society at the end of the day. That's just a few of my thoughts there. So again, we'll open up to the floor for discussion. And so, whatever both of us have said.
And you raised a number of points that I was going to say myself. Specifically, I think racism is a symptom of capitalism and the society that we have. And if you tie that in with what's called the globalisation movement, and the way it spreads even in the wake of chaos or post-conflict situations where they want privatisation of industry, reductions in social spending, etc., etc., which really affects the working classes and stuff like that. Within that forms of bitterness, and as you say to yourself, that's where the racism comes in, where they sort of point, well, it's their fault that this has happened, divide the working class, divide the potential of the united front and stuff like that. But I think what I had seen, I think the problem with anti-racism is it's often seen as a symptom. It's not the root cause. I mean, you can bother away at symptoms, but until you hit the root cause, you're going to come up against this again and again and again. And also, in modern times, people are now beginning to realise the illusion of a two-party state. But there's a danger in that realisation as well. It creates a political vacuum of being empty or cashed on a big time in the UK at the moment. But again, it's back to that. You've got to see it as we go on also, this capitalism and how these are all symptoms that spread from it. We have to cut it, we have to attack it, you know what I mean?
Are there any questions? Issues? Just Okay.
How is the situation now in Northern Ireland with regards to sort of about racism and talking about actual physical attacks? Racism, has it improved from the time you're talking about?
Well, I remember back the time Philip called the racial capital of Europe, right? And when I went back on, I went back on what I said at the, during the part of the introduction I gave there, is that as we develop into a so-called normal society, and the normal society is within the confines and the remit of the ruling classes, that within this system and within those confines, there will always be racist attacks, there will always be racism. And so we see presently less of the overt attacks. That's not to say that they do not happen, because many of those attacks go unrecorded through fear, through threats, through people who have language barriers and stuff, so a lot of it goes unrecorded. You also have seen, I have seen the rise of the less overt racism. That's a subtle racism. And the difference, going back a few years when seeing racist attacks, the difference was this. In working class communities and working class areas, where capitalism runs right through the lives of working class people and drives them down with low pay, with lack of housing, lack of opportunity and stuff like that there, what you will see reciprocated, and what you have seen reciprocated, was the overt visible confrontation rise of racism within working class communities, aimed at those who they perceive were the problem, rather than aiming the problem of who was the core of the problem, and that is the nature of the system itself. Coupled with the visible overt rise in working class communities, given the social and economic deprivation, and that turned against the people who they perceived were the problem, you have the middle class areas, and more fluent areas, where the racism is overt, which you'll hear in the dinner tables of those with money. You hear the subtle racism coming out. And that will be played out overtly in those areas, because the areas of those have different needs, they have different interests, they're policed differently, because at the end of the day, the ruling classes are the ones who control the means of production, they control the judiciary, they control the police, they control the military, and so their interests within those areas are to keep those interests together. In working class areas, that whole system is used to keep and oppress and repress those people down. So, to go back to your question, yes, there are still attacks. Yes, there is still the rise of overt and subtle racism being played here. But you don't see it as much on the media now. You don't see it reported as much now. That's not to say that it doesn't go on. It still goes on. If you go back to the time and recall the race hate capital of Europe, you've seen real physical, visible attacks. You've seen the linking of those attacks within parliamentary organisations. You've seen the linking of those attacks to individuals who are associated with fascist and far-right organisation. So my fear is that when we go on, and my understanding is quite simple, that when we go on from a post-conflict situation, when the reconstruction has been put in, you'll still have a society which is based on global capitalism, on neoliberalism, and if people raise their heads up, they will repress and oppress them. So that's the nature of the system. So within that there, I do believe you will see an increase, not so much as the overt racism, but more of the subtle racism. But in time, I believe you will see more and more people linking to far-right fascist organisations as some of those paramilitary organisations are brought to the end, and you'll see those like the BNP and other far-right organisations coming here and attacking the organised here, which at the minute they haven't had any real success. And the final point I'll say is that those who have those far-right fascist ideas, they understand the nature of their history, of their lessons, of their gains, and their lessons of their defeats. So they know presently that they'll come to your door. They'll come to your door now with skinheads and boots and bomber jackets, black suits on. Presently, they'll come to your door in a nice suit and tie, rapping at your door in, "Hello, Mrs. So-and-so, hello, Mr. So-and-so, ah, it's Desperate. You know what the problem is here? You have lack of housing, you're not getting jobs, you've got the same pretenders living out here, they're all working." And that's what they do, they use it, they use that tactic as well, they learn lessons in their class. But if they're getting the chance to commercial, if they get a chance to grow, those suits will be taken off, and then they'll get their bomber jackets back on, they'll have their skinheads, they'll have their militias beginning to build. And that's the lesson of our history, of how you actually confront these people, and it's about actually physically confronting them. And having that solidarity and the collective mobilisation of working class citizens who are prepared to take that on. And that's my understanding of the situation and my understanding politically of the situation of where we are now, where we need to go to, and if it arises, what we have to do.
Do you think, because of the history of parliamentary organisations here, people here are more vulnerable to that kind of thing arising than, say, in other places?
What sense are you?
For example, in England, at the moment there are several places where the BNP are getting a bit of a stronghold. And do you think the situation in Northern Ireland, similar things happening here?
Well, in regards to paramilitary organisations, if you look back at the history of the recent Irish War, what you've seen developing is you have had the Republican side, who have more or less aligned themselves with the solidarity to left-wing groups, and you've had the Loyalist side, the Ben Lars, who have linked themselves to far-right groups. You just have to look at the likes of Johnny Adair, Marshall Food, the Skinhead, Union Jack, National Front, or something like that, I think it was on at that time. So that has been the ideology within those organisations. And so, as those organisations begin to dismantle, begin to go down, the alienation still within working class communities of young people and youth will be directed somewhere. That's the reality in the history of capitalism. That's the reality of living in areas which are socially and economically depraved. So while many people join organisations for various reasons, when those organisations go out of business, as are in the different, you know, old boys societies, whatever's going to happen, that they will still leave behind that alienation and deprivation. And the reality of the situation is that we're seeing a government installment which, interest, which they've already stated, is for business rather than need. And so, with the development and pushing of the neoliberal agenda, and the lack of social housing and all those other working class communities, there will very possibly be a rise. And the rise of people who, young people especially, will be directed in different areas. What we want to see is for working class communities to collectively come together, Catholic, Protestant, Dissenter, whatever religion and nationality, whatever accent they speak, to come together to try and affect change for those communities collectively. Then you have the other side of the list, the BNP and stuff like that, who will try and go in those communities, offer what they'll put across as we'll deal with these issues here, but they want to direct those energies in our other areas. It is worrying, the rise of the BNP and such in England and stuff like that there. But, you know, our history is where we learn the lessons of the past, and that is the collective mobilisation of working class citizens against it. And if these people choose or develop or get to the situation they want to replace their suits with their bomber jackets and their militias, whatever, then at the end of the day, the only way forward with organised fascism is on the streets, is to physically confront them with the strength of working class.
David, based on your experience, do you think racist attacks is more stronger in Protestant working class communities, given the often there's a large part of these linked with racist groups? And also, it's interesting, recently, Nick Griffin's visit to the North last year, he's trying to tap in now his common theme as Catholic Protestant at the Sinti against immigrants. But they had the organisers private, we had a private function, it was advertised, it was published in some of the papers the next day. The one thing the British National Party, they'll never gain root, particularly in nationalist working class communities, based on the fact that, mainly because they're called the British National Party. Seeing regards to misdirected energy, presently I don't think that I have stopped the job. The reason why the BNP are gaining support is obviously they're talking about these issues, housing, unemployment, blah blah blah, and that's what we have to do if we want to grow strong. We're just direct talking about other obscene, irrelevant issues to most people on the doorstep, like, and that's basically why they're gaining support, and that's why the left is presently is dead.
Well, thank you for your pessimistic point, sir, and for your that's, you know, the realization is basically a redeeming.
It's more provocative as well.
Redeeming with reality, you know. History has always shown us that, you know, as the situation starts to bubble in regards to the ills of society being penetrated, as always, a working classer is with penetrating, say, the credit crunch or, you know, those things that are happening, and when it starts to affect the middle classes, then you start to see real problems starting to arise. Your point of nationalism, I will say, yes, history has shown that in recent decades and before, that nationalism has always tended to be more opening in regard to the stand against racism. But you have to couple that with the understanding that nationalism can be right-wing as well as left-wing. Nationalism as an ideology isn't based on left, right or centre. Nationalism as an ideology is based on the present time of war, that direction of their leadership, and also within the ideas of that particular community are orientated. So, you know, nationalism in many ways, you know, has many forms. There's nationalism, it's national socialism, there's the left-wing nationalism. So you can't turn around and say, you know, the lesson will always be that nationalism will be more or less, because nationalism and ideology moves from side to side. That's not to say at present that, and this goes back to the point that I stated, that nationalism and working class areas and nationalist communities are more, they would have more of a stand against reason. And the reality is because of those nationalist communities in the last decade or so, they've understood the nature of oppression, brutality. They have also voted and marched with those organisations who are linked to left-wing organisations. So that is the present history. That's not to say that nationalism can't go to the right wing. You just have to look at the Streets of Ireland to see that there, and some of the things that those sitting in government have said about migrants. So when you talk about nationalism, you have to understand it as an ideology and not a concept that doesn't move from right, a concept that doesn't move from left to right. So presently, yes, I agree that in nationalist communities, at the time I was involved in it, there was more garden of solidarity within those communities than there was in loyalist communities. And I go back to the point that based on the ideology that loyalism had been historically linked to far-right organisations. That's not to say that working-class Protestants and working-class loyalists, you know, won't come out and support, because they did come out, not in great numbers, but they did come out in support of a stand against racism and those attacks. And what you see develop through the period of the ARN is that pressure was brought to an extent, and this is what the reality of the United Front is about. Because on the United Front, on a specific issue, it's not about fundamental change and overthrowing of the system, although those within it would have that politic. It's to deal with an issue that people have come together in a common cause for a common purpose. So the pressure of the mobilisations from below affected some change in above. And that was what it was about at that period of time. It was not about the overthrowing of the system, because the majority of people who were involved in it weren't for that. It was a united front to take a stand against racism. Within it, as I've said to you, there was those organisations, and I've said it for the first time, there was those individuals in there who were actually meeting and prepared to discuss a way of attacking marches, and it needs to be to go and physically confront them, and I think the name we offered was Squads. But in summing up, I believe you have to understand nationalism as an ideology, so rather than specific at a specific time. And I do believe that, you know, there will be
the possible opportunity for the rise of far-right fascist individuals to come together as an organisation here as time goes on. And your last point, being provocative, as you said, the left is dead. You know, history always throws up many different situations. With the PC and is the person, sorry, what's your name again?
Uh-huh.
Danny was saying besides you there, you know, international capitalism and globalisation stuff, all these factors link directly to where we are here in the north of Ireland. And so at the end of the day, with those pressures coming from above being pushed down below, it means that they're being pushed out further and further. The pressure's always on working class communities, but the pressure now will be spiraling towards middle class communities. And history has shown that those communities are rife in many, many ways, in individual cases and also collective cases, to move further and further to the right for their own self-interest. And that's where dangerous situations can arise. And that's, you've even seen, I think it was Gordon Brown came out last week, turned around and says that with the cryptocurrency, believes that there's going to be a rise in far-right activity and organisations. Sorry?
That's a fact. Most of us know that there, even before he came out, like, from...
But that's the reality of the situation, so that's the point that's happening in that regard.
A couple of points. Nationalism itself, as I see it, is a breeding ground for racism, to the extent that when you join a nation, you exclude all other nations from it. And we have to develop historical context, but that's a philosophy, the racism and current racism underneath nationalism. The second point would be, which Sean Mickey you touched on a wee bit, was about the way the BNP, how are they moving forward at the moment? It's because they're using key issues. Look at their website. Environmental issues, even animal rights, these are the things that they're doing. And a few contacts during the elections in London there were telling me that the DNP were going around, were slipping a fiver into a leaflet in old people's house. There's even an exit for the funeral book. This is a tactic to know your enemy, know what they're up against. Visit their website, look at the approach that they're taking, and find ways to counter it.
Okay. Any other parts, questions? Issues?
The way basically counter it, as far as I'm concerned, is we have to build a strong libertarian movement in Ireland which agitates on these, on housing, workplace struggles, etc., as well as linking physical direct action towards fascist groups and in the future. And just going back to what you were saying there, Davey, about squads, there was a temporary group set up at the time anyway. He was confronting fascist groups and approaching, etc., especially physical confrontation with fascist groups under the fascist campaign.
No, I'm aware of that there. I'm talking about the specifics to the area. There was issues coming about the safety of those who were protesting and marching, because there was all the ages, young people through the old people, parents are older citizens, and all different people who had different beliefs, and that was an issue in that front. So, as I said, this was individuals who were discussing the way to protect the march. To go on and physically confront them. I'm aware of fascists out having involved in disrupting fascist organisations, but the RAM wasn't set up as a anti-fascist organisation, it was set up as an anti-racism organisation, and there is political differences, I believe, as to how you confront racism as opposed to how you confront organised fascism. Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much for coming to the meeting there. Okay, we'll have a discussion afterwards if you want to take it any further. Okay, thanks a lot.